The Never Dry. In the cab ride on the way to the Never Dry, Bailey keeps pulling on her bottom lip, almost like a nervous habit she suddenly developed, her eyes darting from side to side, frantic and terrified. I hear the questions she's not asking me out loud, and I don't want to push her. I also can't just sit there and watch her suffer, so I search obsessively on my phone for Catherine, Kate Smith, for Charlie Smith, for anything I can possibly tell her, any new information I can offer up in an attempt to soothe her. But I find way too much. Smith is too common of a last name, even with my sub-searches. UT Austin, Austin native, debate champion. There are hundreds of hits and images, none for the Catherine who greeted us at the library. Which is when I have an idea. I plug Andrea Reyes into my search, along with Charlie Smith, and I finally hit on something that may help us. A Facebook profile for the correct Charlie Smith pops up. He is a 2002 graduate from the University of Texas at Austin, with a BA in art history, followed by 2 semesters at the Graduate School of Architecture and an internship at a landscape architecture firm in downtown Austin. No work history after that. No status updates or photographs since 2009. But it says that his wife is Andrea Reyes.
"There it is," Bailey says. She points out the window to a blue door, vines around it. You could almost miss it. The Never Dry, written on a small gold plaque. It sits there quietly, kitty corner to West 6th Street, a coffee shop on one side, an alley on the other. We hop out of the taxi, and as I turn to pay the driver, I see that our hotel is visible across Lady Bird Lake. I feel a strange pull, wanting to call this off, head back there. Then Bailey goes to open the blue door. And as she does, something happens that has never happened before. Call it maternal instinct. I grab her arm before I know I am grabbing it.
"What the hell?" she says.
"You wait here."
"What?" she says. "No way."
I start thinking quickly, the truth not feeling possible to say. What if we walk inside there and see her, this Catherine Smith? What if your father took you away from her? What if she tries to take you from me? And yet there it is, feeling possible enough that it is the first thing that occurs to me. "I don't want you in there," I say. "They'll be more likely to answer my questions if you're not in there too."
"That's not good enough, Hannah," she says.
"Well, how's this?" I say. "We don't know whose bar this is. We don't know who these people are or whether they are dangerous. All we know is that it's looking more and more like your father may have taken you from here, and knowing him, if he did that, there was something he was trying to protect you from. There may have been someone he was trying to protect you from. You cannot go inside there until I find that out." She is quiet. She stares at me unhappily, but she stays quiet. I motion toward the coffee shop next door. It looks quiet, almost empty, after the afternoon rush. "Just go sit inside and get yourself a piece of pie, okay?" I literally couldn't want a piece of pie less, she says. "Then get a cup of coffee and keep working on Professor Cookman's roster. See if you can pull anyone else up on a search. We still have a long way to go." "I don't like this plan," she says. I pull the roster out of my messenger bag. I hold it up for her. "I'll come and get you when it's all clear in there."
"Clear of what? Why don't you just say it?" she asks. "Why don't you say who you think is inside?"
"Probably for the same reason you're not ready to say it, Bailey." This gets through to her. She nods her agreement. Then she takes the roster out of my hand and turns toward the coffee shop.
"Don't take too long, okay?" she says.
Then she opens the door to the coffee shop, a whoosh of purple as she heads inside. I breathe a sigh of relief,
and I open the blue door to the Never Dry. There is a winding staircase, which I take upstairs to a candle-lit hallway and a second blue door, which is also unlocked. I open that door and enter a small cocktail lounge, an empty cocktail lounge. There are maple rafters and a dark mahogany bar, velvety love seats surrounding small bar tables. It doesn't feel like a college town bar. The hidden doorway, the intimate room, it feels more like a speakeasy, guarded, sexy, private. No one is standing behind the bar. The only indication that anyone is even there is the lit tea candles on the cocktail tables, Billie Holiday playing on an old record player. I walk up to the bar, taking in the shelves behind it. They're filled with dark liquors, boozy bitters, and there is one shelf devoted to framed photographs in thick silver frames, a few framed newspaper clippings. Kate Smith appears in several, along with the same lanky, dark-haired guy. Not Owen, someone besides Owen. There are several photographs of the dark-haired guy alone as well. I lean over the bar and try to make out what one of the newspaper clippings says. It includes a photograph of Kate dressed in a gown, the lanky guy dressed in a tuxedo. An older couple bookends them. I start to read through the names beneath the photograph. Meredith Smith, Kate Smith, Charlie Smith. Then I hear footsteps. Hey there! I turn around to see Charlie Smith, the lanky guy from the photographs. He's wearing a crisp button-down shirt and holding a case of champagne. He looks older than in the fancy framed photographs, less lanky. His dark hair is now graying, his skin weathered, but it's definitely him. Whoever he is to Bailey. Whoever Bailey is to Kate. We're not open just yet, he says. We don't usually start serving until closer to 6. I point back from the direction I came. I'm sorry about that. The door was unlocked, I say. I didn't mean to just let myself in. Not a problem. You can have a seat at the bar and take a look at the cocktail menu, he says. I just have a couple more things to take care of. Sounds great, I say. He puts the champagne on the bar and offers a kind smile. I force a smile back. It isn't easy being around this stranger who has the same coloring as Bailey, and his smile, when he points it at me, is hers too, complete with her same uptick, the same dimple shining through. I hop up on a stool as he moves behind the bar and starts unpacking the champagne. Can I ask you a quick question? I'm new to Austin, and I think I got a bit turned around. I'm looking for the campus. Can I walk from here? Sure, if you have 45 minutes or so. Probably easier to just hop in an Uber if you're in any kind of rush, he says. Where are you headed to exactly? I think of his bio, of what I just pulled up about him. The School of Architecture, I say. Really? He says. I'm not a good actress, so trying to look casual while telling this lie is a stretch. It pays off, though. He's interested suddenly, just like I hoped he would be. Charlie Smith, late 30s, almost architect, married to Andrea Reyes. Married to Andrea at a wedding Bailey and Owen attended. I took some classes at the School of Architecture once upon a time, he says. Small world, I say. I look around to stop my heart from racing, to center myself. Did you design this place? It's gorgeous. Can't really take that much credit. I did a bit of a redesign when I took it over, but the bones are the same. He finishes putting the champagne away and leans across the bar. Are you an architect? He asks. Landscape architect, and I'm in the running for a teaching position, I say. Just a temp position, while one of the professors is on maternity leave. But they want me to come have dinner with some of the faculty, so I'm hopeful. How about a little liquid courage, he says.
What would you like to drink?
Dealer's choice, I say.
That's dangerous, he says, especially when I've got a little time. Charlie turns and studies his choices, reaches for a bottle of small-batch bourbon. I watch as he preps a martini glass with ice, bitters, sugar. Then he slowly pours the rich bourbon, finishing it with a slice of orange peel. He slides the drink toward me. The house specialty, he says. A bourbon old-fashioned.
That looks too pretty to drink, I say.
My grandfather used to make the bitters himself. Now I do it, most of the time. I'm falling down on the job a bit, but it makes all the difference.
I take a sip of my drink, which is smooth and icy and strong. It runs straight to my head.
So this is your family's bar?
Yeah, my grandfather was the original proprietor, he says. He wanted a place to play cards with his buddies.
He motions to the one velvet booth in the corner, a reserved sign on it. There are several black and white photographs above it, including a great one of a group of guys sitting in that booth. He spent 50 years behind the bar before I took it over from him.
Wow, I say. That's incredible. What about your father?
What about him? He says.
And I clock it. How uncomfortable he looks at the mention of his father.
I was just wondering why you guys skipped a generation, I say. He wasn't interested?
His face relaxes, my question apparently innocuous enough for him.
No, not really his thing. This place was my mother's father's, and she was definitely not interested.
He shrugs.
And I wanted the gig. My wife, or ex-wife now, had just found out she was pregnant with our twins, so my days as a student needed to be over.
I force a laugh, trying not to react to the fact that he has kids, plural. I try to figure out how to press on that, to wrap this conversation around to his wife, to the wedding, to where I need it to go, to Kate.
Maybe that's why you look familiar, I say. This is going to sound crazy, but I think we met a long time ago.
He tilts his head, smiles.
Did we?
No, I mean, I think I was here at the bar back when I was in college.
So, it's the Never Dry that looks familiar?
I guess that's more accurate, yeah, I say. I was in town with a girlfriend for the hot sauce competition. She was photographing it for a local paper.
I figure as much truth as I can muster is a good thing.
And I'm pretty sure we came in here that weekend. This place doesn't look like a lot of other bars around Austin.
It's certainly possible. The festival isn't held too far from here.
He turns and pulls a bottle of Shonky Sauce Company Purple Hot Sauce off his shelf.
This was one of 2019's winners. I use it to make a pretty feisty Bloody Mary.
That sounds like a commitment, I say.
It's not for the faint of heart, that's for sure, he says.
He laughs and I brace myself for what I'm about to do.
If I'm remembering this place correctly, the bartender working here that night was a total sweetheart. She gave us all sorts of tips for places to eat. I remember her. Long, dark hair. She looked a lot like you, actually.
That's some memory you have, he says. I might be getting a little help.
I point toward the shelf of silver-framed photographs. I point toward one in which Kate is staring back at me.
Maybe it was her, I say.
He follows my eyes toward the photograph of Kate and shakes his head.
No, not possible, he says.
He starts wiping down the bar, completely tightening up. And this is when I should drop it. This is when I would drop it, if I didn't need his help to get to it. Who Kate Smith is.
Weird. I could have sworn it was her.
Are you guys related? I say.
He looks up at me, the look in his eye changing from avoidance to irritation.
You ask a lot of questions, he says. I know, sorry. You don't have to answer that, I say. It's a bad habit.
Asking too many questions?
Thinking that people want to answer. His face softens. No, it's fine, he says. She's my sister, and it's just a little sensitive 'cause she's not with us anymore.
His sister. He said she was his sister, and he said she isn't with them anymore. This breaks something in me. If this is Bailey's mother, she is lost to her. Bailey has lived her entire life thinking her mother is lost to her. But this will be in an entirely new way. She will be lost to her as soon as she found her, which is why the next thing I say is the truth.
I'm sorry to hear that, I say. I'm really sorry.
Yeah, he says. Me too. I don't want to push him further on Kate, not now. I can check death certificates when I leave here. I can check with someone else to learn more. I start to get up, but Charlie scans the shelf until he finds a specific photograph. It's a photograph of Charlie with a dark-haired woman and two little boys, both of the boys dressed in Texas Rangers jerseys.
Maybe it was my wife, Andrea, he says. That you met, I mean. She worked here for years. When I was in school, she put in more shifts than I did.
He hands me the picture frame. I look closely at the photograph, at this nice family staring back at me, at his now ex-wife shining a lovely smile at the camera. It probably was her, I say. It's weird, isn't it? I don't know where I put the room key for my hotel, but her face I think I remember.
I hold on to the photograph.
Your boys are adorable.
Thank you. They're great kids. But I need some new photographs in here. They were 5 in this photo, he says, and now they're 11, which, as they would be quick to tell you, is essentially voting age.
11. That stops me. 11 would line up almost precisely with when he and Andrea got married, Andrea getting pregnant shortly before or shortly after the wedding.
They play me a bit now, though, since the divorce. Think I'll cave to all their demands just so I get to be the cool dad. He laughs. They win more often than they should.
Probably okay, I say.
Yeah, he shrugs. You got kids?
Not yet, I say.
Still looking for the guy.
This is truer than I want it to be. And Charlie smiles at me, perhaps wondering if I meant it as an invitation.
I know this is the moment to ask the question I need an answer to most. I stall as I think of how to get there.
I should probably get going, but maybe I'll head back if I get done early enough.
Definitely, he says. Come back, we'll celebrate.
Or commiserate, he smiles.
Or that.
I stand up, as if I'm about to leave, my heart threatening to beat out of my chest.
You know, this is a bizarre question. Is it okay if I ask you, before I head out? I figure you know a lot of locals.
Far too many, he says. What do you need to know?
I'm trying to find this guy. My girlfriend and I met him when we were here that time, a lifetime ago. He lived in Austin, probably still does, and my friend had this huge crush on him.
He looks at me, intrigued.
Okay. Anyway, she's going through a crappy divorce and he's stuck in her head. That sounds ridiculous, but since I'm back in town, I thought I'd try to find him. It would be a nice thing to be able to do for her. They had a connection, 1 million years ago, but connections are hard to find, so...
Do you have a name?
He says.
Not that I'm great with names.
How about faces?
I say.
I'm pretty good with faces, he says. I reach into my pocket and pull out my phone, click through to the photograph of Owen. It's the photograph that we showed Professor Cookman, the one on Bailey's phone, the one I asked her to text me. Bailey's face covered with flowers, Owen smiling, happy. Charlie looks down at the photograph. And it happens so quickly. He throws my phone down, cracking it against the countertop. He is over the bar and in my face. He isn't touching me, but he is so close that he could. "Do you think this is funny?" he says. "Who are you?" I shake my head, frightened. "Who sent you?" he says. "No one." I back up against the wall, and he moves closer to me. His face and my face, his shoulder almost touching my shoulder. "This is my family you're messing with," he says. "Who sent you here?"
"Get away from her!"
I look in the doorway to see Bailey standing there. She is holding the class roster in one of her hands, a cup of coffee in the other. She looks scared, but more than that, she looks angry, like she is going to hurl a bar stool at him if she needs to. Charlie looks like he has seen a ghost. "Holy shit," he says. He moves away from me slowly. I take in a deep breath and then another, my heartbeat slowing down. We are in a weird standstill. Bailey and Charlie stare at each other as I pull myself off the wall. There are no more than 2 feet between any of us, but no one is moving, not toward each other or away. Charlie, all of a sudden, in tears. "Kristen," he says. At the sound of him calling her by a name, even a name I don't recognize, I stop breathing.
"I'm not Kristen," she says.
Bailey shakes her head, her voice catching. I reach down and pick my cell phone up off the floor. The screen cracked, but it's working. It's still working. I could dial 911. I could get help. I inch backward toward Bailey. Protect her. Charlie puts his hands up in surrender as I reach Bailey, the blue door right behind us, the stairs and the outside world just beyond that. "Look, I'm sorry about that. I can explain. If you just sit down," he says. "Take a minute. Can you both do that? Have a seat? I'd like to talk, if you'll let me." He motions toward a table where we can all sit, and he steps away from us, as if giving us a choice, and I see he means it, in his eyes. He looks more sorrowful than mad. But his skin is still bright red, and I don't trust the anger I saw, the fear. Wherever it came from, I can't have Bailey around it, not until I know what his stake in this is, what I suspect his stake in Bailey is. So I turn to Bailey. I turn to Bailey and grab her shirt at the small of her back, roughly, pulling her toward the door. "Go," I say, "now." And as though it is something we know how to do, we run down the stairs together, then outside into Austin's streets and away from Charlie Smith. Careful what you wish for. We move quickly down Congress Avenue. I'm trying to get back to our hotel room on the other side of the bridge. I need to get us somewhere private where we can collect our things and I can figure out the fastest way out of Austin.
"What happened in there?" Bailey says. "Was he going to hurt you?"
"I don't know," I say. "I don't think so." I put my hand on the small of her back, steering her in and out of the after-work crowd, couples, groups of college kids, a dog walker handling a dozen dogs. I move sideways, hoping to make it harder for Charlie to follow us, in case he is trying to follow us. This man who was so angry at seeing a photograph of Owen that he exploded.
"Faster, Bailey." "I'm going as fast as I can," she says. "What do you want me to do? It's a clusterfuck."
She isn't wrong. Instead of the crowds letting up as we get closer to the bridge, there are more people, all clamoring to get onto the bridge's narrow walkway. I turn back to make sure Charlie isn't following us, which is when I see him, several blocks behind. Charlie. He is moving at a fast clip, but he hasn't spotted us yet. He looks to the left and to the right. The Congress Avenue Bridge is straight ahead. I grab onto Bailey's elbow and we head onto the bridge's walkway. But the foot traffic is moving slowly, if at all, the entire walkway jammed up with people. It's good in the sense that it is easier to blend in, but everyone seems to have stopped moving. Mostly everyone on the bridge is at a standstill, many of them looking down at the lake below.
"Did these people forget how to move?" Bailey says.
A guy in a Hawaiian shirt, carrying a large camera, a tourist if I were guessing, turns back and smiles at us. Apparently, he thinks Bailey's question is directed at him.
"We're waiting on the bats," he says.
"The bats?" Bailey says.
"Yeah, the bats. They feed every night right around now."
This is when we hear, "Here they come!" And, in a bright flood, hundreds and hundreds of bats start to fly up from beneath the bridge out into the sky. The crowd cheers as the bats move in an almost ribbon-like formation, an enormous, orchestrated, beautiful swarm of them. If Charlie is still behind us, I can't see him. He is gone, or we are gone, two revelers observing the bats take flight on a pretty Austin night. I look up at the sky, flooded with the bats, moving as if in a dance together. Everyone applauds as they disappear into the night. The guy in the Hawaiian shirt angles his camera to the sky, shooting pictures as they depart. I slide past him and motion for Bailey to keep up. "We have to move," I say, "before we get stuck here." Bailey picks up the pace, and we make it over the bridge, both of us breaking into a jog. We don't stop until we turn down our hotel's long driveway. We don't stop until we are in front of the hotel, the doorman holding the door open.
"Just wait," Bailey says. "We need to stop for a second."
She puts her hands on her knees, catching her breath. "I want to argue. We are so close to being on the safe side of the hotel's doors, so close to the privacy of our small room."
"What if I told you I remembered him?" she says.
I look over at the doormen, who are chatting with each other. I try to meet their eyes, get them to focus, as if they will keep us safe.
"What if I said I know him, Charlie Smith?"
"Do you?"
"I remember being called by that name," she says. "Kristen." Hearing him say it, all of a sudden I remembered. How do you forget something like that? How is that even possible?
"We forget all sorts of things that no one helps us remember," I say. Bailey gets quiet. Silent, actually. Then she says it. The words both of us have avoided saying out loud.
"You think that woman Kate is my mother, don't you?"
She pauses on the word mother like it has fire in it. "I do. I could be wrong, but I do."
"Why would my father lie about who my mother is?"
She meets my eyes. I don't try to answer her. I have no good answer for her.
"I'm just not sure who I should be trusting here," she says.
"Me," I say. "Just me." She bites her lip, like she believes me, or at least like she is starting to believe me, which is more than I could hope for in this moment. Because you can't tell people to trust you. You have to show them that they can. And I haven't had enough time. The doormen are looking at us. I'm not sure they are listening, but they are looking, and I feel it. I feel how much I need to get Bailey out of here, out of Austin. Immediately. "Come with me," I say. She doesn't fight me. We walk past the doormen and into the hotel lobby, head to the elevator bank. But as we step inside, a man gets on too. A young guy who I think is looking at Bailey strangely. He wears a gray sweater vest, piercings covering his ears. I know it is paranoid to think he is following us. I know it.
If he is looking at Bailey, it is probably only because she is beautiful. I'm not taking that chance, though. So I move us off the elevator and toward the back staircase, heart pounding. I open the door, point toward the staircase. "This way," I say. "Where are we going?" she says. "We're 8 floors up." "Just be glad it's not 20. 18 months ago. "Is there anything else I should know?" I asked, "before this plane takes off? Are we talking metaphorically or actually? Like the actual mechanics of the plane? Because I did do a brief stint at Boeing when I first got to Seattle." We were on the flight from New York to San Francisco, a one-way ticket for me. The shop had sprung for first class for both of us, because Owen had been in New York for business in preparation for the shop's IPO. Owen had stayed on for the initial reason he'd been planning to be in New York that week, to help move me out of it. We had spent the last few days packing up my apartment, packing up my studio, and when we landed, I'd move into his home, his and Bailey's. It would become my home, too. And soon, I would be his wife. "I'm asking what you left out, about you." "While you can still get off the plane? We haven't started taxiing yet. There's probably still time." He squeezed my hand, trying to make light of it, but I was still jumpy. I was suddenly too jumpy. "What do you want to know?" he said. "Tell me about Olivia," I said. "I've told you a lot about Olivia," he said. "Not really. I feel like I know only the basics. College sweetheart, teacher, Georgia born and bred." I didn't add the rest. That he lost her in a car accident. That he hadn't been involved, seriously, with anyone since. "Now that I'm going to be in Bailey's life in a serious way, I want to know more about her mother." He tilted his head, like he was considering where to start. "When Bailey was a baby, we all took a trip to Los Angeles. It was the weekend that a tiger escaped from the Los Angeles Zoo, a young tiger who had been at the zoo for only a year or so. He didn't just escape his cage, but the entire premises, and he ended up in a family's backyard in Los Feliz. When he got there, he didn't hurt anyone. He curled up under a tree and took a nap. Olivia was consumed with the story, which is probably how she found out the other part." I smiled. "What's that?" "The family whose backyard the tiger had curled up in had gone to the zoo only a few weeks before, and one of their 2 young boys had been obsessed with the tiger. The boy had cried when he had to leave the tiger, not understanding why he couldn't take the tiger home with him. How do you explain that the tiger ended up at this boy's home? A coincidence?" That was what the zoologists decided. The family lived pretty close to the zoo. But Olivia thought it served as proof that sometimes you find your way to the place that wants you most.
I love that story.
You would have loved her, he said. Then he smiled, looked out the airplane window. There was no way not to love her.
I squeezed his shoulder. Thank you. He turned back toward me.
Do you feel better?
Not really, I said. He laughed.
What else do you want to know?
I tried to think of what I was asking for. It wasn't about Olivia. It wasn't even about Bailey. Not exactly, at least. I think I need you to say it out loud, I said.
Say what?
That we're doing the right thing. That was the closest I could get to it, the closest way to express what I was actually worried about. I wasn't used to being a part of a family, not since I lost my grandfather. And that didn't exactly feel like a family. That felt like a twosome, plowing our way through the world, just me and him.
His funeral was the last time I even saw my mother. Her calls on my birthday, or somewhere around my birthday, were our only form of communication at this point. This was going to be something different. It would be the first time I was a part of an actual family. I felt completely unsure of how to do it properly, how to count on Owen, how to show Bailey she could count on me.
"We're doing the right thing," Owen said. "We're doing the only thing. I swear to you on everything that matters to me. That's how I feel."
I nodded, calmed, because I believed him, and because I wasn't really nervous, at least not about him. I knew how much I wanted him, how much I wanted to be with him. Even if I didn't know everything about him yet, I knew that he was good. I was nervous about everything else. He leaned in and put his lips against my forehead.
"I'm not going to be that asshole who says you kinda have to trust someone at some point."
"You're going to be the asshole who says it without saying it?" The airplane started backing up, jolting us, before it turned, slowly heading toward the runway.
"Apparently," he said.
"I know I can trust you," I said. "I do. I trust you more than anyone." He locked his fingers through mine.
"Metaphorically or actually?" he said.
I looked down at our fingers, locked together like that, just in time for takeoff. I stared down at them, finding comfort there. "Here's hoping they're the same thing," I said. The Good Lawyer. When we get back to the hotel room, I lock the deadbolt behind us. I start looking around the room, our belongings strewn on the floor, our suitcases open. "Start packing your stuff," I say. "Just throw it all in the suitcase. We're out of here in the next 5 minutes."
"Where are we going?"
"To rent a car and start driving home."
"Why are we driving?" she says.
"I don't want to say the rest of it. That I don't even want to go to the airport. That I'm afraid they'll be looking for us there, whoever they are. That I don't know what her father did, but I know who he is. And anyone who reacts to him the way that Charlie reacted to him is someone we can't trust. He's someone we need to get away from."
"And why are we leaving now? We're getting closer."
She pauses.
"I don't want to leave until we figure this out."
"We will, I promise you. But not here," I say. "Not where you could be in danger." She starts to argue, but I put up my hand. I rarely tell her what to do, so I know it may go south starting now. But still, she has to listen. Because we have to leave. We should be leaving already.
"Bailey," I say, "there's no choice. We're in over our heads."
Bailey looks at me, surprised. Maybe she is surprised that I tell her the truth, that I don't sugarcoat it. Maybe she just wants to be done trying to convince me that I'm wrong to head back home. I can't read her expression. But she nods and stops arguing, so I decide to take the win.
"Okay," she says. "I'll pack."
"Thank you," I say.
"Yep,"
she says. She starts picking up her clothes, and I walk into the bathroom, closing the door behind myself. I look into the mirror at my tired face. My eyes are bloodshot and dark, my skin pallid. I splash water on my face and make myself take a few deep breaths in, trying to slow down my heartbeat, trying to slow down the crazy thoughts that are plowing through my mind, one of them finding its way to the surface anyway. What have I gotten us into here? What do I know? What do I need to know? I reach into my pocket, palm my cell phone. I cut my finger on the shattered screen, the small glass shards embedding in my skin. I pull up Jake's contact and send a text. "Please get back to me on this ASAP. Catherine Kate Smith, that's her maiden name. Brother Charlie Smith, Austin, Texas. Cross-reference for birth of daughter, matching Bailey's age. Name, Kristen, Austin, Texas. Also check for marriage certificate and death certificate. Won't be reachable on my phone. I put the phone under my foot and get ready to smash it, even though it is the only way Owen can find us. It's also the way anyone else can. And if my suspicions are right, I don't want that. I want to get out of Austin without that happening. I want to get away from Charlie Smith and whoever may be with him. But there is something gnawing at me, something I want to remember before I disconnect us from the world. What is bothering me? What do I feel like I should be finding? Not Kate Smith, not Charlie Smith, something else. I pick up the phone and do another search for Catherine Smith. Thousands of links popping up on Google for such a common name. Some that seem like they could be leading to the right Catherine, but don't. An art history professor who graduated from University of Texas at Austin. A chef born and bred on Lake Austin. An actress who looks quite a bit like the Kate I saw in the photos at the bar. I click on the link to the actress and pull up a photograph of her in a gown. And it comes to me in a flash, what I am trying to remember, what struck me at the Never Dry. There was that newspaper clipping I noticed when I first arrived at the bar. The clip included a photograph of Kate dressed in a gown. Kate in a gown, Charlie dressed in a tuxedo, the older couple bookending them. Meredith Smith, Nicholas Bell. The headline read, Nicholas Bell receives the Texas Star Award. His name was also beneath the clipping. Nicholas Bell, husband of Meredith Smith. She was in other photographs, but he wasn't. Why was he in so few photographs except for that clipping? Why did his name sound familiar? I plug in his name, and then I know. This is how the story started. A young, handsome El Paso, Texas presidential scholar was one of the first kids from his high school to attend college, let alone the University of Texas at Austin, let alone law school. He came from modest means, but money wasn't his motivation for becoming a lawyer. Even after a childhood where he didn't often know where his next meal was coming from, he turned down all sorts of job offers from firms in New York and San Francisco to become a public defender for the city of Austin. He was 26 years old. He was young, idealistic, and newly married to his high school sweetheart, a social worker, who had aspirations for beautiful babies, but none at the time, for fancy houses. His name was Nicholas, but he quickly earned the nickname the Good Lawyer, handling the cases no one wanted, helping out defendants who wouldn't have gotten a fair shake with someone who cared less. It is unclear how Nicholas went from there to becoming the Bad Lawyer. It is unclear how he became the most trusted advisor to one of the largest crime syndicates in North America. The organization was based out of New York and South Florida, where their top leaders lived in places like Fisher Island and Oceanfront South Beach. They played golf and wore Brioni suits and told their neighbors they worked in securities. This was how the new regime operated, quietly, efficiently, brutally. Their lieutenants preserved their stronghold in several core businesses, extortion, loan sharking, narcotics, while also moving into more sophisticated revenue streams, like international online gaming and brokerage fraud on Wall Street. Most notably, though, they bulked up their OxyContin business long before their competitors saw the opening there. And while these competitors were still primarily shilling the traditional illegals,
heroin, cocaine. This organization became the largest trafficker of oxycodone in North America. This is how Nicholas wound up in their orbit. One of the organization's young associates found himself in trouble in Austin while distributing OxyContin at UT Austin. Nicholas managed to keep him out of prison. Nicholas then spent the better part of the next 3 decades fighting on behalf of this organization, his work leading to acquittals or mistrials on 18 counts of murder, 28 indictments for drug trafficking, 61 counts of extortion and fraud. He proved himself invaluable and got wealthy in the process. But as the DEA and the FBI kept losing case after case against him, he became a target, too. He remained unafraid they'd find anything that added up to his being anything more than a devoted attorney. Until something went wrong. His grown daughter was walking down the street on her way home from her job, her beloved job. She was a clerk for the Texas Supreme Court, a year and change out of law school, a new mother. She was walking home after a long week when a car struck her. It would have looked like any other accident, any other hit and run, except that she was hit on a small street near her Austin house, and it was a clear day, and it was a Friday afternoon. And Friday afternoons were when Nicholas spent time at his daughter's home, watching his granddaughter, just the two of them. It was his favorite time of the week, picking his granddaughter up from music class and taking her to the park with the good swings, the park that was a block away from where his daughter was killed. So he'd be the one to find her. So he'd be the one to see it. His clients said they had nothing to do with the accident, even though he had just lost a major case for them. And it seemed like the truth. They had a code. They didn't go after people's families. But someone had done it, as vengeance, as a warning shot. There was speculation that it had been members of a different organization who were aiming to secure his services for themselves. None of these details mattered to his daughter's husband, though, who could only blame his father-in-law. The fact that it occurred on a Friday afternoon convinced him that his father-in-law's employers were involved one way or another, and regardless, he blamed his father-in-law for his deep entanglement with the kind of people that made it a question in the first place, that could bring this kind of tragedy to a family. Not that the good lawyer had wanted his daughter to be hurt. He'd always been a great father and was devastated by her death. But his son-in-law was too angry to care. And his son-in-law knew things. He knew things the good lawyer had trusted him not to share with anyone else. Which was why the son-in-law was able to turn state's evidence against his father-in-law and become the lead witness in a case that put his father-in-law in jail while casting a blow to the organization itself, 18 members of the organization implicated in the sweep. The good lawyer carted off behind them. The son-in-law and his small daughter, who would have only a couple of memories of her mother, of her grandfather, disappeared after the trial, never to be heard from again. The lawyer's full name was Daniel Nicholas Bell, a.k.a. D. Nicholas Bell. His son-in-law went by the name of Ethan Young. Ethan's daughter's name was Kristen. I drop my phone to the ground and smash it. I smash it in one quick motion, kicking it hard with my foot, as hard as I've ever kicked anything. And I open the bathroom door. I open the bathroom door to get Bailey and grab our things and get the hell out of Austin. Not in 5 minutes. Not in 5 seconds. Now. Bailey, we need to get out of here right now, I say. Just grab what you've already packed. We're going. But the hotel room is empty. Bailey is no longer there. She is gone. Bailey?
My heart starts to race as I reach for my phone to call her, to text her, and I remember that I just smashed my phone. I have no phone. So I run into the hallway, which is empty, save for a housekeeping cart. I run past it and toward the elevator bank, the staircase. She isn't there. No one is there. I take the elevator down to the hotel lobby, hoping she went to the hotel bar to get a snack. I run into the hotel restaurants, each of them, into the Starbucks. Bailey is not there either. Bailey is not anywhere. You make 100 decisions. You make decisions all the time. And the one you don't think of twice shouldn't get to determine what happens to her. Go into your hotel room, double bolt the door. You think you're safe. But then you head into the bathroom. You head into the bathroom and trust a 16-year-old to stay on the bed, stay in the room, because where is she going to go? Except she is terrified. Except there is that. Except she told you she didn't want to leave Austin. So why did you believe she would go without a fight? Why did you believe she would listen to you? I race back into the elevator, race back down the hall. I am enraged at myself that my phone is broken on the bathroom floor, that I don't have it to text her, that I don't have it to turn on locations and track her. Bailey, please answer me. I head into the hotel room and look around again, as though she will be hiding somewhere in those 580 square feet. I search the closet, search under the beds anyway, hoping to find her huddled in a ball, crying, needing to be alone, miserable, but safe. How quickly I would take that. Miserable, safe. The door swings open. I feel temporary relief. It is a relief I have never felt before, thinking Bailey is back, thinking that I just missed her when I did my frantic search in the hotel, that she did, after all, just go down the hall to get a bucket of ice or a soda, that she went to call Bobby, that she found a cigarette and went outside to smoke it, any of it, all of it. But Bailey isn't standing there. Grady Bradford is. Grady is standing there in his faded jeans and backward baseball cap, his stupid windbreaker. He drills me with an angry look, his arms crossed over his chest.
So you certainly went and made a mess of everything now, he says.
Part 3. Rotten wood cannot be carved. Confucius. When we were young. The U.S. Marshal's office in downtown Austin is on a side street, its windows peering in on other buildings, peering in on the parking garage across the street. Most of those buildings are now dark and closed for the night. The parking lot is mostly empty, but Grady's office and his colleagues' offices are lit up and bustling.
Let's walk through this again, Grady says.
He sits on the edge of his desk as I pace back and forth. I can feel his judgment, but it's unnecessary. No one is judging me more than I'm judging myself. Bailey is missing. She's missing. She is out there alone. How is this helping to find Bailey? I say. Unless you arrest me, I'm going out there to look for her. I start to walk out of the office, but Grady hops down from his desk and blocks my exit.
We have 8 deputies looking for her, he says. What you need to do right now is go through it all again. If you want to help us find her, that's the only thing to do.
I hold his gaze but relent, knowing he's right. I walk back over to the windows and look outside, as though there is something I can do, as though I'll spot Bailey somewhere on the street below. I don't know who I'm looking at, the myriad of people walking through nighttime Austin. The sliver of moon, the only light, makes it feel even more terrifying that Bailey is roaming among them. What if he took her? I say.
Nicholas? He says.
I nod, my head starting to spin.
I go obsessively over everything I know about him now. How dangerous he is. The heights Owen went to get away from him. To keep his daughter away from Nicholas's world. How I've brought her back. Protect her.
That's unlikely, Grady says.
But not impossible?
I guess nothing is impossible, now that you brought her to Austin.
I try to comfort myself, something Grady apparently has no desire to do. He couldn't have found us so quickly, I say.
No, probably not.
How did you even find us? I ask.
Well, your call this morning didn't help. And then I heard from your lawyer, a Jake Anderson in New York City. He told me you were in Austin and he couldn't reach you, that you went dark and he was worried, so I put a trace on you. Clearly not soon enough.
I turn and look at him.
Why on earth would you come to Austin? He says. You showed up at my house for starters, I say. I found that suspicious. Owen never told me you were a detective.
Owen never told me about any of this, period. It seems unwise to harp on the fact that I wouldn't have come here if Grady had told me what was going on, if anyone had told me the truth about Owen and his past. Grady is too angry to care. Still, I can't stop myself. If we are pointing fingers, they shouldn't be pointed at me. In the last 72 hours, I've learned that my husband isn't the person I thought he was. What was I supposed to do?
What I told you to do, he says. Lay low. Get yourself a lawyer. Let me do my job.
And what is that exactly?
Owen made a decision over a decade ago to get his daughter out of a life he couldn't protect her from otherwise. To give her a clean start. I helped him do that.
But Jake told me... I thought Owen wasn't in the protection program.
Jake would have been correct that Owen wasn't in witness protection. Not exactly.
I look at him, confused. What the hell does that mean?
Owen was set to join WITSEC after he agreed to testify, but he never felt safe. Thought there were too many holes, too many people he'd have to trust. And during the trial, there was a small leak.
What do you mean, a small leak?
Someone in the New York office compromised the identities we had secured for Owen and Bailey, he says. Owen didn't want any part of government involvement after that.
Shocking, I say.
It wasn't typical, but I did understand why he wanted to go another route, why he disappeared with Bailey. No one knew where they were going. No one else in the Marshals Service knew. We made sure there wasn't a line that would lead to him.
Grady flew halfway across the country to check on Owen, to check on his family, to help Owen out of this mess.
Except you mean, I say.
He trusted me, he says.
Maybe because I was new here then. Maybe I earned it.
You'll have to ask him why. Can't really ask him much of anything at the moment, I say.
Grady walks over to the windows, leans against them.
Maybe it's because I'm looking for it, but I see something in his eyes, something like sympathy.
Owen and I don't talk a whole lot, he says. For the most part, he's just been living his life. I think the last time he reached out was when he told me he was marrying you.
What did he say?
He told me that you were a game changer, he says. He said he'd never been in love like that before.
I close my eyes against it. How deeply I feel that, and how deeply I feel the same.
Truth is, I tried to talk him out of pursuing anything with you, Grady says. I told him his feelings would pass.
Well, thank you for that.
He wouldn't listen to me about walking away, he says. But he did take my advice, apparently. When I told him he couldn't tell you about his past, that it was too dangerous for you, that if he really wanted to be with you, he needed to leave his past out of it.
I think of the two of us in bed, Owen struggling with whether to tell me, Owen wanting to tell me the entire truth of his past. Maybe Grady's warning stopped him. Maybe Grady's warning stopped Owen and me from being in a position to handle this together.
Is this your way of telling me I should blame you instead of him? I say. Because I'm happy to do that.
This is my way of telling you we all have secrets we don't share, he says. Kind of like your lawyer friend, Jake. He told me that you guys were engaged once upon a time.
That's not a secret, I say. Owen knew all about Jake.
And how do you think he'd feel about you involving him in this? He says.
I was running out of choices, I want to say. But I know it's a fool's errand to argue with him. Grady is intent on putting me on the defensive, as if that will make it easier for him to pry something out of me. Not exactly a secret, more like my will. My will to do anything but listen to what he thinks we should do now.
Why did Owen run, Grady? I ask.
He had to, he says.
What does that mean?
How many photographs have you seen of Avid in the news this week? The media would be all over Owen, too. His picture would be everywhere, and they'd find him again. Nicholas's employers. Even though he looks different than he did, he doesn't look that different. He couldn't risk that kind of exposure. He had to get out of there before that happened, he says. Before he blew up Bailey's life.
I take that in. It makes me understand in a different way why there was no time to tell me anything. Why there was no time to do anything but go.
He knew he would have been brought in, he says. And when he was, he would have been fingerprinted, just like Jordan Maverick was this afternoon. And that would reveal who he actually was. Game over.
So they think Owen's guilty? I say.
Naomi, the FBI, whoever else?
No. They think he has answers they need. That's a different thing, he says.
But if you're asking me if Owen was a willing participant in the fraud, I would say not likely.
What's more likely?
That Avid knew about Owen.
I meet his eyes.
Not any of the specifics. Owen would never have told him. But he knew he hired someone who came out of nowhere. No references to speak of. No ties to the tech world. Owen said at the time that Avid just wanted the best coder he could find. But I think Avid was looking for an angle. He wanted someone he could control. If it turned out, he needed that control. And it turned out he did.
You think Owen knew what was happening at the shop, but he couldn't stop it? I say.
That he stayed there hoping he could fix it, get the software operational before he got caught in the crosshairs.
I do, he says. That's a pretty specific guess, I say.
I know your husband pretty specifically, he says. And he's been watching his back for such a long time that he knew if the shop scandal touched him, he'd have to disappear all over again. Bailey would have to start over. And this time, of course, she'd have to be told the history. Not ideal, to say the least.
He pauses.
Let alone what you would have had to give up, assuming you chose to go with them.
Assuming I chose to go?
Well, you couldn't really hide out as a wood turner. Even a furniture designer, whatever you call yourself. You would have to give up everything, your job, your livelihood. I'm sure he didn't want that for you.
I flashed to it, one of my early dates with Owen. He asked me what I would do if I hadn't become a woodturner, and I told him that it was probably because of my grandfather. Maybe it was because I associated woodturning with the only stability I'd ever had, but it was all I'd ever wanted to do. I had never really imagined doing anything else.
He didn't think I'd choose to go with them, did he?
I say, more to myself than to him.
That doesn't matter now. I've managed to tamp it down, to keep your friends at the FBI at bay, he says. But I won't be able to pull rank much longer, unless you guys are officially being protected.
Meaning Witsec?
Yes, meaning Witsec.
I don't say anything. Trying to take in the weight of that. I can't begin to fathom being a protected person. What will that look like?
My only experience with anything close is what I've seen in the movies. Harrison Ford hanging out with the Amish in Witness. Steve Martin sneaking out of town to get the good spaghetti in My Blue Heaven. Both of them depressed and lost. Then I think of what Jake said. How in reality, it's nowhere near as good as that. So Bailey will have to start over, I say. New identity? New name? All over again?
Yes. And I'd take starting over for her, he says. I'll take it for her father, too, as opposed to what's happening now.
I try to process that. Bailey, no longer Bailey. Everything she has worked so hard for, her schooling, her grades, her theater, herself, it will be erased. Will she even be allowed to perform in musicals anymore? Or will that be a tell, a way to lead people to Owen? The new student at a random school in Iowa starring in the school musical. Will Grady say that's another way they can track them? That instead of pursuing her old interests, she has to take up fencing or hockey or just completely stay under the radar? Any way you shake it out, it certainly means Bailey will be asked to stop being Bailey. At the exact moment she is becoming singularly, inimitably herself. It feels like a staggering proposition to give up your life when you're a 16-year-old. It's a different position than when you were just a toddler. It's a different proposition when you're 40. But still, I know she would pay that price to be with her father. We would both gladly pay that price, again and again, if it meant we could all be together. I try to find comfort in that, except there is something else gnawing at me. Something Grady is skirting around that isn't sitting right. Something that I can't hold in my hands just yet. Here's what you've got to understand, he says. Nicholas Bell is a bad man. Even Owen didn't want to accept how bad of a man he was, not for a long time, probably because Kate was loyal to her father, and Owen was loyal to Kate and to Charlie, who Owen was quite close to as well. They believed their father was a good man with some questionable clients, and they convinced Owen of that. They convinced him that Nicholas was a defense attorney, doing his job, no illegal activity of his own. They convinced him because they loved their father. They thought he was a good father, a good husband. He was a good father, a good husband. They weren't wrong. He is just other things, too. Like what? Like complicit in murder and extortion and drug trafficking, he says. Like completely and totally unrepentant for how many lives he helped ruin. Like how many people whose entire fucking world he helped destroy. I try not to show it on my face, how that gets to me. These men that Nicholas worked for are ruthless, he says, and unforgiving. There's no telling what kind of leverage they would use to get Owen to turn himself in. They could go after Bailey, I say. That's what you're saying? That they'd go after Bailey to get to Owen? I'm saying unless we move her quickly, it's a possibility. That stops me, even in the heat of this, what Grady's insinuating. Bailey being in danger. Bailey, who is wandering the streets of Austin alone, potentially already in danger. The point is, Nicholas won't stop them, he says. He couldn't stop them, even if he wanted to. That's why Owen had to get Bailey out. He knew Nick's hands weren't clean in any of this, and he used that information to hurt the organization. Do you understand that? Maybe you should say it slower, I say.
Nicholas wasn't always dirty, but at some point he started passing messages for leadership from lieutenants in prison to leadership outside of prison. Messages that couldn't be sent another way except through a lawyer. And these weren't innocent messages. These were messages like who needs to be punished, like who needs to be killed. Can you imagine knowingly passing along a message that would result in a man and his wife being killed and their two kids being left without parents. And where does Owen come in? Owen helped Nicholas set up an encryption system that Nicholas ultimately used to send these messages, to record these messages when they needed to be recorded, he says. After Kate was killed, Owen hacked into the system and turned everything over to us. All the emails, all the correspondence. Nicholas served more than 6 years in prison for conspiracy to commit, which we were able to prove directly from those files. You don't betray Nicholas Bell like that and come back from it. This is when it hits me. The piece that has been gnawing at me. The piece that Grady hasn't been addressing. So why didn't he come to you then? I say. Excuse me? Why didn't Owen come straight to you? I say. If the only way this ends well, if the only way to truly keep Bailey safe now is for her to be in witness protection, for Owen to be in witness protection, then when everything in the shop blew up, why didn't Owen reach out to you? Why didn't he show up at your door and ask you to move us? You'll have to ask Owen that. I'm asking you, I say. What happened with the leak last time, Grady? Did you guys nip it in the bud? Or was Bailey's life compromised? What does that have to do with what's happening now? Everything. If what happened made my husband think you can't keep Bailey safe now, it has everything to do with what's happening now, I say. The bottom line is that WITSEC is the best option that Owen and Bailey have for staying safe, he says. Period. He says this without apology, but I can see that my question got to him, because he can't deny it. If Owen were really certain that Grady could keep Bailey safe, that he could keep all of us safe, he would be here with us now, as opposed to wherever he is. Look, let's not get sidetracked here, he says. What you need to do now is help me figure out why Bailey left the hotel room. I don't know why, I say. Wager a guess, he says. I think she didn't want to leave Austin, I say. I don't add the details. She probably didn't want to go yet, not when she was so close to finding answers of her own, answers to questions about her past, answers Owen left me ill-equipped to even begin to deal with. It calms me somewhat to believe this is the reason, to believe she is alone somewhere, but safe, searching for answers she doesn't trust anyone else to find for her. I should recognize that trait in someone. I have it myself. Why do you think she wants to stay in Austin? He says. At the moment, I tell him the only piece of truth I know. Sometimes you can sense it, I say. Sense what? He says. When it's all up to you. Grady gets called into a meeting. And a different U.S. Marshal, Sylvia Hernandez, leads me down the hall and into a conference room, where she says I can make a phone call, as though the call isn't being taped or traced or whatever else they do here to make sure they know everything you do, before you even do it. Sylvia sits outside the door, and I pick up the phone. I call my best friend. I've been trying to reach you for hours, Jules says when she picks up. Are you guys okay? I sit down at the long conference room table, holding my head in my hand, trying not to fall apart, even though it feels like the moment to fall apart, when I am safe to, Jules there to catch me. Where are you? She says. I just got a crazy call from Jake screaming about how your husband is putting you in danger. Can't say I miss that guy. Yeah, well, Jake is Jake, I say. He's just trying to help. In his incredibly unhelpful way. What's going on with Owen? He didn't turn himself in, did he? She says. Not exactly. What exactly? She said, but she says it softly, which is also her way of saying I don't need to explain right now. Bailey is missing, I say. What? She says. She took off. She left the hotel room, and we can't find her. She's 16. I know that, Jules. Why do you think I'm so scared? No, I'm saying, she's 16. Sometimes disappearing for a bit is what you need to do. I'm sure she's fine. It's not as simple as that, I say. Have you heard the name Nicholas Bell?
Should I have?
He's Owen's former father-in-law. She is silent, something coming to her.
Wait, you don't mean Nicholas Bell, like the Nicholas Bell, the lawyer?
Yes, that's him. What do you know about him?
Not a lot. I mean, I remember reading in the papers when he was released from prison a couple of years ago. I think he was in there for assault or murder or something.
He was Owen's father-in-law? She says. I don't believe it.
Jules, Owen's in big trouble, and I don't think there's anything I can do to stop it. She is quiet, thoughtful. I can feel her trying to add up some of the pieces that I'm not helping her see.
We'll stop it, she says. I promise you. First we'll get you and Bailey home, then we can figure out how.
My heart clutches in my chest. This is what she has always done, what we have done for each other. And this is why I can't breathe suddenly. Bailey is wandering the streets of this strange city, and even when we find her, and I have to believe they'll find her soon, Grady just informed me that I'm not going home. Not ever.
Did I lose you? She says.
Not yet, I say. Where did you say you were?
I'm home, she says.
And I got it open. The way she says it is loaded, and I realize she is talking about the safe, the small safe inside the piggy bank.
You did?
Yep, she says. Max found a safecracker who lives in downtown San Francisco, and we opened it about an hour ago. His name is Marty, and he is about 97 years old. It's insane what this guy can do with a safe. He listened to the machine for 5 minutes and opened it that way. Stupid little piggy bank made of steel.
What's inside?
She pauses.
A will. The final will for Owen Michaels, nay, Ethan Young.
Do you want me to tell you what it says? I think about who else is listening. If Jules starts to read, I think of who else will be listening to Owen's will. Not the will I pulled up on his laptop computer, but the will that the other will alluded to, as if in a secret message to me. Owen's real will, his more complete will. Ethan's will.
Jules, there are probably people listening to this call, so I think we should stick to a few things, okay?
Of course.
What does it say about Bailey's guardians?
That you're her primary guardian, she says, in case of Owen's death, but also in case of his inability to care for her himself.
Owen prepared for this. Maybe not exactly this, but something like this. He prepared for it in a way that Bailey would get to be with me. That he wanted Bailey with me. At what point did he trust me enough to do that? At what point did he decide that being with me was what was best for her? It breaks something wide open in me to know that he got there, that he thought I could do it. Except now she is missing, somewhere in this city, and I allowed that to happen too.
Does he mention any other names? I say.
Yes, there are different rules based on whether you can't care for her or based on Bailey's age, she says.
As she reads, I listen to her carefully, taking notes, writing down the names I recognize. But really, I'm listening for just one name. One person who I am trying to figure out whether to trust, whether Owen trusts, despite any and all evidence that he shouldn't. When I hear it, when she says, Charlie Smith, I stop writing. I tell her I need to go.
Be careful, she says.
This instead of goodbye, instead of her usual, I love you. Considering the circumstances, considering what I need to figure out how to do now, it's the same thing. I stand up and look out the conference room windows. It has started raining,
Austin nightlife active below despite it. People walked the streets with umbrellas, heading to dinner and shows, debating about a nightcap or a late movie, or deciding they've had enough, that the rain is getting harder and they want to go home. Those are the lucky ones. I turn toward the glass door. U.S. Marshal Sylvia sits on the other side. She is looking at her phone, either disinterested in me or busy with something more important than her babysitting assignment. Perhaps she is busy with the one thing I know about too well. Finding Owen. Finding Bailey. I'm about to walk into the hall and demand a status update when I see Grady walking down the hall. He knocks on the door as he opens it and smiles at me, a softer Grady who seems to have thawed somewhat.
They have her, he says. They have Bailey. She's safe.
I let out a breath, tears filling my eyes. Oh, thank goodness. Where is she?
Up at campus. They're bringing her back here, he says. Can we talk for a minute before they do? I just think it's really important that we are on the same page with her about what the plan is going to be.
What the plan is going to be? He means the plan to move her, to move us. He means that he wants me to help hold it all steady when he tells her that her life as she knows it is over.
And we need to talk about something else, he says. I didn't want to get into it before, but I haven't been completely transparent with you.
I wouldn't have guessed.
We received a package yesterday with a zip drive of Owen's work emails. I had to verify they were real, and they are. He kept meticulous records of the pressure Avitt was applying to push through the IPO, despite Owen's objections, and all the work he did after to try and make it okay.
It wasn't just a specific guess, then, I say, about Owen's culpability in all this.
No, I guess not, he says.
So it's really my husband who tamped it down, I say. My voice rises. I try to check it, but I can't. Because Owen is doing everything to protect us, even from wherever he is now, and I just don't trust that Grady knows how to do the same.
He has certainly helped, he says. Witsec can be challenging about who they're willing to help out. And these files plus his history underscore why he didn't blow the whistle until now, why he felt he had no choice but to stay on board.
I take this in, feeling a weird mix of relief and something else. At first, I think it's irritation at Grady for withholding this, withholding that he'd heard from Owen, but then I realize it's something more sinister. Because it's starting to crystallize for me. What else Grady's been withholding from me? And why are you sharing this information with me now? I say.
Because we need to be a united front when Bailey gets here, he says. About Witsec. About the best way for you guys to move forward. And I know it doesn't feel like it, but you won't be starting over. Not completely.
What does that mean?
It means that money Owen left for Bailey, it's legitimate earnings. It's money Owen kept clean, he says. You'll be entering Witsec with a nice nest egg. Most people in our program don't have anything close.
Sounds to me, Grady, that you're saying if we decline, the money goes away.
If you decline, all of it goes away, he says. Being a family again, safely, goes away.
I nod, knowing what Grady's trying to convince me of. That I should be on board with Bailey and me entering protection. That I need to be on board, because everything is set up for Owen to join us in this new life. Everything is set up for our family to be reunited. New names, but reunited. Together. Except this is what I can't let go of, despite Grady's insistence. What I know Owen doesn't want me to let go of. My doubt. My doubt when I think about the leak at Witsec, and when I think about Nicholas Bell. My doubt when I think about Owen's hasty exit and what I know about him, which would explain it. The only thing that would explain it. Everything I know about Owen
is convincing me of something else. Grady is still talking. We just need Bailey to understand that this is the best way to keep her as safe as possible, he says. As safe as possible. That stops me. Because he doesn't just say safe. Because there is no safe. Not anymore. Bailey isn't wandering the streets, but she is on her way to this office, and to a world in which to be as safe as possible, Grady is going to tell her she is going to have to become someone else. Bailey, no longer Bailey. Unless, of course, I manage to stop it. All of it. Which is when I brace myself against it. What I need to do now. Look, we can get into all of this, I say. The best way to handle Bailey. But I just need to go to the restroom first. Splash some water on my face. I haven't slept in 24 hours. He nods. No problem. He holds the door open, and I start to head out of the conference room, pausing in the doorway, pausing when I'm right next to him. I know this is the most important part, making him believe me. I'm so relieved she's safe, I say. Me too, he says. And look, this isn't easy, I get that. But this is the best thing to do, and you'll see Bailey will get comfortable with it sooner than you think. And it won't all seem so scary. You'll get to be together, and we'll get to bring Owen to you as soon as he reemerges. I'm sure that's what Owen's waiting for now, to make sure you're safe first, make sure you're all set up. Then he smiles, and I do the one thing I can. I smile back. I smile like I trust him that he knows why Owen is still gone. Like I trust a relocation will be the answer he and his daughter need to be together, to be safe. Like I trust that anyone is capable of keeping Bailey safe, except for me. Grady's phone rings. Give me a minute, he says. I point toward the restroom. Can I? Sure thing. Go ahead, he says. He is already walking toward the windows. He's already focusing on whoever is on the other end of his phone call. I head down the hall and in the direction of the restroom, turning back to make sure Grady isn't watching. He isn't. His back is to me, his phone to his ear. He doesn't turn around as I walk past the restroom's door and to the elevator, where I press the down button. He keeps staring out the conference room windows, staring at the rain while he talks. The elevator arrives blessedly fast, and I jump in, alone, pushing the close button. I'm in the lobby before Grady gets off his phone call. I'm outside in the rain before Sylvia Hernandez is sent into the ladies' room to check on me. I have turned the corner before she or Grady look on the conference room table and see what I left there for them to find. I left the note on the table beneath the phone, the note that Owen left me. I left it for Grady. Protect her. And I walk at a quick clip down the unfamiliar Austin streets to be there for Bailey now, to be there for her and Owen the best way I know how, even though it's taking me back to the last place I am supposed to go.